You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
It's 7:35 here on a Wednesday. Good morning to you. If you're on the East Coast like our next guest, it's not really morning anymore. It's mid-morning, so hope everybody had their coffee. But we're just having a, off the air, Dr. Niemeyer and I were just having a big conversation about being a smart guy in the Marine Corps. And so, sir, first of all, I just want to, you sounded like St. Peter after Jesus was being interrogated, denying that you were a smart guy in spite of your PhD.
Well, it's a safe thing to do when you're in and around the Marine Corps, that they want you to be smart, but not too smart.
the biggest thing we don't want you to do is don't act smart.
That's right, exactly, because then you really turn people off.
Because let me tell you, the nickname that every smart guy knows it's trouble, if you get tagged with genius.
Oh, no, you don't want that. That would be bad.
Where's genius?
It's because you'll do something dumb, and they'll say, yeah, once again, genius is apt to it.
Come over here. But you know what? It is that way in the Marine Corps. We like smart guys. Just don't act smart, because you will get it fed to you.
That's right. That's very true.
All right. So, Dr. Charles Niemeyer. Now, sir, I've seen a number of different titles that you own. So what is your official title?
I'm the director of the U.S. Marine Corps History Program, as well as the Gray Research Center here at Quantico, Virginia.
So, director of U.S. Marine Corps History Program. Does that mean you're like in charge of all the history? Is there another guy?
We have a history division. Actually, I should say program, but I'm the program manager. But we have a history division that I'm in charge of, and it's a bunch of historians and as well as editors and publishers and reference historians and archivists whose job it is to preserve, promote, and publish Marine Corps history, and that's what we do.
Now, tell me about the Gray Research Center. That's how many years old now?
It was built in 1994, so it's a little bit over 20 years old. It was it's connected here as the kind of the library of the Marine Corps, as well as the special collections and archives for the Marine Corps. So we'll have really cool stuff from the Marine Corps past history in particular. Let me give you an example. We have Clifton Cates's diary from Belleau Wood. Really, really cool stuff that as a second lieutenant, he's writing about getting ready to go into his first combat action. He ends up coming out of that fight being the only officer left alive in his company.
Wow. You know, can I make a confession about the library?
Sure.
Is there a statute of limitations in terms of...
Oh, you got a book?
In terms of criminal activity?
Well,
no,
like,
it wasn't
so
much a book. It was, and I would even call it breaking and entering. It was just entering. On Thanksgiving, I was teaching at the basic school. I was teaching at the infantry officer course in 1990-91. And I had books from the library, the old library, and it was not a very big place. And I went to take them back on Thanksgiving, figuring, look, nobody will be around, so I can, these are overdue, let me slide them in, and nobody will, and then I'll deny that they were late. There you go, that'll work. So I went to take it in, and the door was ajar. So, as a good captain, I thought, well, let me investigate this, maybe something's wrong. So I walked in, and there was nothing wrong, and the door to the collections was unlocked. Exactly. So, being a reader, I thought, now, I could go home and spend, like, a few hours with my family on Thanksgiving, or I could go in the collections room, and I could wreak havoc in there. I went in the collections room, and there was all these different works in there, you know, that you just salivated about, you know, original manuscripts and just incredible stuff. And so I sat there for 2 hours and then got yelled at. Not really yelled at, but my ex-wife's eyes rolled like, where have you been? I thought you just went to take a book back.
How long does it take to return a book is right.
You won't believe what happened. And you know what specifically I was looking for? The Marine Corps adopted during the Vietnam era in the FMFM 6-5 a technique that was called the assault fire technique, where when Marines got to the final coordination line in an assault, base of fire shooting on the objective, that everybody stood up and you kind of walked across the objective, you know, shooting people. And that always struck me as stupid. And I thought, what is there nobody else that's going to shoot you if you're walking across the objective? Why wouldn't you just, you know, bound through the objective continuing to fight? And I wanted to find out. I mean, most of the guys who do this stuff, they're not stupid guys. They do it for a reason. And it doesn't appear in the versions right after World War II. And I'm not sure, I know you're the director of the history division, but I'm not sure if you know this. We did a lot of fighting in World War II. So
I heard we did.
I heard about that, and I've seen some videos. It looked crazy,
yeah.
But I thought, well, if it doesn't appear after World War II when we do a lot of close combat, where the hell did it come from? So it pops up in like 1966, and so I started asking around, like, who the hell wrote? Hey, which genius wrote this and put it in? And I actually kind of traced it, and they explained to me, you know, what they were trying to articulate and whatnot. So, is that technically breaking and entering? I didn't do anything nefarious.
I think that as long as nothing was taken, you're just, you know, there, and it was just an opportune moment. And plus, like you said, statute of limitations are probably long expired.
All right, I'm absolved. We can continue with the interview.
Yes.
The first of all, let's find out about you. Born and raised where?
I was in Baltimore, Maryland.
Born and raised
Baltimore.
That's a dump, huh?
Yeah, well, now it is. But back then it was less of a dump back then, but it was still kind of rough to live. It was a rough neighborhood, but there's some great parts of Baltimore still there. It just, you know, some places are good, some places are not.
Memorial Stadium.
Memorial Stadium. I used to go there to see the Orioles. I was a junior Oriole.
Were you?
All the kids in the neighborhood joined this club called the Junior Orioles, and you got bleacher tickets, and you could take the bus to the stadium and watch the Orioles. And I used to go watch Brooks Robinson and Boo Powell and all those guys play.
They were great. Davey Johnson, Mark Belanger.
Oh, yeah, Davey Johnson played second base. Mark Belanger, shortstop, yeah.
Elrod Hendricks could gun anybody out anywhere. Andy Etchebarren.
You know the team.
Oh, I know them. Don Buford, Paul Blair. Don Buford fought in Vietnam.
Yes, he did.
Army lieutenant, infantry. I think he was an infantry guy too.
He was a great ball player. We got him from Chicago, if I recall.
Yeah, and then who played right field?
Right field was Russ Snyder.
How about that? There you go, the Baltimore, and then the pitching lineup. All good looking guys because they never wore their hats. Led by Jim Palmer, Dave McNally, Mike Cuellar, and
there's Roberts. What's his name? I can't remember. Pat Roberts, I think, he was the four-star. The year they won the World Series, first time they ever won a World Series in 1966, they had 4 20-game winners.
Who was
think
the
about that
time?
Record? All four starters won 20 games.
They were good.
Earl Weaver was the manager later on, but 66 it was Hank Bauer, who was a Marine, by the way.
My dad was involved in Major League Baseball, and his first. We'll get to what we're supposed to talk about here in a few minutes. But my dad wins. He's a high school senior in 1947, 48, 49, some maybe 49. He born and raised in Sacramento, California. He plays in an all-star game in San Francisco in Seal Stadium. He's named the MVP of the game. He wins a train ticket and tickets to three of the games at World Series games in New York City. So he gets on a train in Sacramento with a scout named Tony Governor, and they go to New York City. He's 18, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. While he's at one of the games, he catches a foul ball.
Wow.
Off the bat of Hank Bauer.
Oh, yeah.
In 1968, he goes to the big leagues with the Oakland A's as a coach. And Hank Bauer's the manager of the A's.
That's amazing.
After he'd been fired in 67 with Baltimore.
Yeah, he brought up Earl Weaver, and then Earl Weaver stuck around for a long time. He brought a lot of good teams back.
Well, you know what Baltimore did is, I don't know what the problem with Bauer was. He probably had some post-combat issues, but he got mad. But
he was a rough guy. He was a real rough cop.
Well, if you read, in fact, Billy Martin.
Earl wasn't any better, but I don't know how.
Yeah,
they were getting better with Earl. But
if Earl was a step down from Hank, that might give you some idea from what Hank Bauer was like. But But I wound up meeting a lot of baseball guys, and Billy Martin was a friend of my dad's, and I flew. He upgraded my ticket when I was flying to Quantico. He was flying to Chicago out of Orange County. We're on the same flight, and he upgrades my ticket to sit next to him, and we talked baseball. And he was telling me about the Copacabana incident where it was Billy Martin, Whitey Ford, Mickey Mantle, Hank Bauer, and their wives go to see Sammy Davis Jr. at this late night performance at the Copacabana in New York City. They're out one night. A bowling convention in the city, these bowlers start calling Sammy Davis Jr. the N-word. And now these guys, they know him. And they turn and they say, hey, shut up. And one of the bowlers says something like, hey, you shut up. And Bauer said, hey, you better shut up, or I'm going to come over there, and I'm going to stuff you into that drink you're drinking. And the guy says, oh, really? Let's go outside. And then the way Mickey Mantle told the story in court was, I didn't do anything. I just walked into the coat room, and three of these guys are on the ground, and Bauer's on the top of them, and I thought Bauer was going to kill him, so I did the right thing, and I tackled Bauer. But I didn't do anything wrong. But they said Bauer, he laid all of them out. And
he was one tough guy. And he served as a Marine and did a great job as a Marine, too.
Interesting. But so anyway, world of small worlds. So you're born and raised in Baltimore, took the bus to Memorial Stadium. Where'd you go to college? Yep.
I went to, as an undergrad, I went to University of Maryland and College Park.
Home of the Terrapins?
Yeah, and then while I was there, when I was a freshman, I was jogging across campus one day, and there was a Marine gunnery sergeant in dress blue standing by the student union. He sees me jogging by, and he says, hey, do you have a summer job? And I said, well, no. You have one? And he says, well, we got this program called platoon leaders class, and you look like you're in shape, and you don't have to be obligated for anything, but you go down to Quantico and sign up for this officer training program, and if you like it, you can stick with it, or if you don't like it, you just stop, you know, participating in the program. So he says, you just got to go through this little thing called OCS, which I had no clue what it was.
Hello.
I kid you not. And this is...
Hold on now. What year is this?
This is 1973.
Okay.
And as I'm jogging, like I said, so he says, well, you know, I got some paperwork here. And he says, if you want to sign up, we'll get you sergeant's pay while you're in. I didn't realize that that's what they gave everybody, was a basic E5 pay to go through PLC. So I go, wow, I get sergeant's pay. So I said, where do I sign? And I kid you not, I signed up on the spot. And I told my mother that weekend, I drove home for the weekend and I took a bus actually and went back to Baltimore. And I said, hey, guess what? I joined the Marines. She almost had a heart attack.
What did she say?
Well, she said, what impelled you to do this? And I said, well, I said, and here's how I got her off the ceiling. I said, I'm not obligated. I don't have to stick with it, but it's going to, you know, I'll do, give me a job this summer and it's pretty good money. And how bad can it be? That was a famous line.
Those are many, eight. Many better men have used that line, sir.
Exactly. And so I said, how bad can it be? And then, of course, they were real nice to me, you know, getting signed up and getting ready to go. And as I drove to Quantico that day, they put me on a bus. They picked me up at then what's called Friendship Airport, now BWI.
Mm-hmm.
And they put a bunch of us that were going together from the Baltimore, Washington area on this bus. And they're real nice. And right until that bus got through the front gate, and then, man, they changed their attitudes entirely.
You know, we laugh about that, but it's interesting. I mean, so all those guys are, you know, they're Vietnam guys.
Yes, all my drone instructors are Vietnam guys. Every one of them.
How much bullshit did they suffer?
That was funny. They a lot of the guys that were in, you know, a lot of the guys with me had gone to Vietnam and gotten, were going to college, and now they're going back as officers. And some of them were NPQ'd out of the program because they had combat injuries.
Wow, really?
All the drill instructors were combat veterans. So it was all the, you know, right after Vietnam ended, and they're trying to put together this all-volunteer force, and it was a lot of difficulty getting, you know, people to stick around and stay in. But some of the Vietnam vets that had been enlisted men during the Vietnam War were coming back, but a lot of them had, you know, combat injuries, and they couldn't, you know, do this, you know, the PFT anymore. They had difficulty, and I remember really good guy, because I had no military experience whatsoever. I was 19 years old, and there was a guy named Taylor. I can't remember his first name, but 1973. So we first day we're working on our boots and trying to put a good shine on the boots, and I'm working and working. I had no idea how to do a spit shine. And Taylor crossed the way for me, and he's looking at my boots, and I look at his, and his look like mirrors. Mine looked like a Hershey bar, you know. And I thought I was pretty good. And I go, "What do you think of this, Taylor?" And he says, "Well, that's pretty good," but he says, "This is where you want them to get." And he holds his boots up, and it was like night and day. I said, "Well, how the hell did you do that?" And he showed me, you know, how to do it. I just took his time, the next day, I got the word Taylor got NPQ'd because he had shrapnel on his wrist and he couldn't do push-ups, and they NPQ'd him.
You know, it sounds so, you know, ridiculous.
Yeah, they were really harsh about it, you know, the physical. I mean, we had to go through a number of physicals if you're ready for training. And I have to admit, after they started screaming at me for the first couple of days and not knowing which way to march or do anything right, I remember very clearly saying, maybe I can get NPQ'd out of here.
Where's the
but
take?
It didn't work out that way. I was physically fit, and I was off to the races after that.
Just a piece of metal in my wrist? Well, there's a lot of metal around here. I could do that.
That's right.
Interesting. Dr. Charles Niemeyer, he's the head of the History Division, United States Marine Corps, joins us here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio. If you have a question or a comment, you can text us at 714-661-8107. You can email live.allmarineradio@gmail.com, or you can call 714-884-4294. So that takes you up to your point of commissioning, and you obviously got commissioned. What was your MOS?
I was artillery. I went to the basic school in 76, 77, and then that was my first choice. Me and a bunch of guys thought it would be really cool. We liked loud guns, and we liked big guns, and at the time, there was very little other MOS opportunities. You had to pick a combat arms of some sort. I picked artillery and got it, and I went to Fort Sill, and then my first assignment was down to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and I was assigned to an 8-inch battery, self-propelled 8-inch, and stayed there for about 2.5 years, and then I got orders to Okinawa, 3rd Marine Division, 12th Marine Regiment, and I was assigned to Mike Battery, 312, and it was a 155 battery. I was the XO for Mike Battery.
So you do that for 20 years as an artillery,
years.
And then you retire in 1996.
Correct.
And so, talk to us about your migration to the to become the director of the History Division.
Yeah, well, when I was on active duty, I had an unusual series of assignments as a major and a lieutenant colonel selectee. I was assigned at one point the White House, and I was on the military office there, and I had started a master's degree with Georgetown prior to getting this White House assignment, and I had completed the master's degree in history, and I thought that's all I needed and that's all I was going to get. And when I came back to Washington, I ran into one of my old professors, and he says, "Well, why don't you sign up and continue your work?" Because they liked what I did the first time around.
What'd you do?
Well, when I was a history major at Georgetown in the early 80s, when I was at Headquarters Marine Corps, and I was able to get the degree, and I did a pretty good job, I guess. So the professor remembered me, and when he saw me again,
what was your dissertation?
Oh, dissertation. It was on the American Revolution.
Okay, so the American Revolution. They liked they liked your work.
They liked my work, and then they said, "Why don't you continue on and get the doctorate?" And so I had to, so I reapplied, and about 2 weeks later, I got an acceptance letter, and so I basically was off to the races. Now, the difficulty I had was I'm still an active duty full-time Marine, and I'm also in a pretty stressful, high-intensity job at the White House, and so I had to basically, every waking moment of every second I had, I was either doing schoolwork or I was working at the White House. So the next 3 years, it was just, I don't even remember. I was constantly working either weekends, evenings, holidays, leave. I worked on that dissertation and eventually got the dissertation finished, right as I was leaving the White House. So, 1993, I was able to get the dissertation May. And, so I had this doctorate and I'm still in active duty I then, you know, again, sort of, what do you do with it? You know, I'm not real sure. So I was talking to the monitor who assigns me my next duty station. I'm up for orders at 93. And he says that, well, you got to go to Okinawa again because you're due. And he says, but on the other hand, he says, I had told him I had gotten his doctorate. And he's the guy that says, you know, well, you really don't want to tell people about that. You really want to keep that a secret. And I said, you know, he says, yeah, it's nice that you got it. You did it on your own time. That's great. And I said, well, I was kind of proud of it because it was one of the hardest things I'd ever done in my life. I mean, it really was an ordeal for 3 years, and he had no clue, obviously, the time I put into it. I did. Anybody says, we just leave this out of your, you know, official record here. Yeah. He says, but let's talk about your next assignment. And so I said, well, I really like to do something in education. He said, I can go to Okinawa. I was screened for command at that point, so I had been put on the command screening list, which was a nice thing for them to do. And I'm looking at Okinawa, and so I said, well, let me talk to my family, and I went home that night, and I said, all right, look, I'm going to stay in the Marine Corps. I got to take these orders to Okinawa because, you know, it's my time, number one, and number two, you know, it's something, you know, that probably want to do if I want to get a command over there. But there's no guarantees to get to command. I mean, you could over there and you could wait for years, you may not get it. But on the other hand, you know, that's what you're, you know, you take your chances. So I'd be on some staff over there. And then the monitor actually gave me this as an option. He says, knowing that, you know, you're a lieutenant colonel now and you have a doctorate, we have a position at the Naval War College as a professor.
Oh.
And so he says, but.
Let me guess. Okinawa, Naval War College.
Yeah. Newport or
And you had a PhD and you actually figured this out. I'll tell you what. You're getting high marks from me, sir.
That's right. Well, exactly what happened, which is I go home and I present it to my family, and they're not real keen on going to Okinawa for 3 years. And so I said to them, I said, look, if I take these orders to the Naval War College, that's my last assignment. And you know, because I was at, you know, the 17-year point at that
right,
point.
Right.
And so, you know, my wife says, well, what do you want to do for the rest of your life after the Marine Corps? I says, oh, I'd like to be in education of some sort. She goes, then why are you worried about going to Okinawa and getting a battalion?
Hello, genius.
Yeah, that's right. So it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. And again, I said, you know, you're right. I said, well, that would be really cool to do, and I really wanted to do it. And again, remember, this is peacetime. It's not wartime.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, I think I'm going to tell them I'm going to take the orders to Naval War College. And it's exactly what I did. And I ended up retiring from the Naval War College at 20 years, as I told the monitor I would do. And then I go to get a job in academia with my degree as well as my background, and I found it was very tough to do. I interviewed all over the place, and 42-year-old Marine, you know, with a PhD, when I showed up, you could see their faces at the interview committee sometimes. They were like, you're not what I expected.
You're not like the rest of the kids.
Exactly. And so I was getting turned down, which is tough for me because I hadn't been turned down for many things in my life. But in this case, they were saying, ah, you're not the candidate we're looking for, that sort of thing. But I finally landed on my feet at a school in Oklahoma, University of Central Oklahoma. And it was a tenure track job, so it was kind of the golden ticket that everybody wants to get, a tenure track history professorship. And they gave me the job, and it didn't pay all that well, but on the other hand, I did get ahead of my retirement check as lieutenant colonel. And then I was only out there for 6 months, and I don't know, it was like a weird situation. 6 months, and I'm doing a real good job, I think, and I get a call from the Naval War College, and they said, hey, we have a civilian professorship position open, and we'll make it worth your while to come back to the Naval War College. And so, as a civilian this time, though.
Wow.
And so I said, well, yeah, I got this new job out here. We're just getting settled in. And so they basically really made it worth my while. In other words, they made it very financially, you know, kind of impressive offer. And I said, and they also made me a full professor, which was real nice. And they said, we really want you back if you can come.
That's called the Vito Corleone.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, made an offer you can't refuse. And so I had to tell the, this is a great story. I had to tell the department chairman at Central Oklahoma. I said, look, I got this fantastic offer, you know, from the Naval War College to come back. And he says, very, and he was a very nice gentleman. He says, well, maybe we can compete for, you know, your services. And he says, what are they offering you? So I wrote the figure down on a piece of paper and I slid it across the table just like out of a movie. Mm-hmm. And he looks at it and he says, can you get me a job? So it was clear that he says, there's no way we can compete. So I said, well, you know, I said, I like it here and I really would appreciate it. And really nice was that as I left Central Oklahoma, the students gave me an award. And it was not a school award. It was a student award. And they gave me the Liberal Arts Teacher of the Year award. And I thought that was really nice for just having been there a year. And so I came back to the Naval War College, and I stayed there for the next 5 years. And my last two was asked by the president to be the dean of academics. So I was a dean there until 2002.
So, and that and then does how do you migrate to the history division?
Well, what happens is there's a little bit of a road there, and then basically I have two other jobs in between the deanship. While dean, the provost at the Naval War College was appointed the president of Valley Forge Military Academy and College, and he was bugging me for about a year to come down there with him to be the vice president of academic affairs at Valley Forge, which I did take. And so I took that position at Valley Forge and eventually stayed there for just a couple of years and then got a position at Regent University as a dean of academic affairs for their government school for another 2 years here in Washington, D.C., because my family's from Washington in the Baltimore area, and I've been trying to get back to this area. So I kind of worked my way down the coast. I was at Newport, Rhode Island, and I was in Philly for a few years. Then I finally made it to Washington. I was a director of a small campus in Alexandria. And then out of the blue, a friend of mine from the Marine Corps sent me an email and says, hey, did you hear they're looking for a new director of Marine Corps history? Colonel John Ripley had just retired, and they had the position had been vacant for about a year. You know, John Ripley's a hero in the Marine Corps. I mean, he's
a legend.
Yeah. Yeah, he is a legend, and Navy Cross recipient, and defended a bridge at Dong Ha. Amazing.
You know,
guy.
You say that name Ripley, and you know, you expect like Ripley Dong Ha. It's like it's almost
right.
One phrase, and you know.
Yeah, he was an amazing guy, but he got to the point now at that point where he wanted to retire. So he retired, and they moved the history division from the Navy Yard, Washington D.C. Navy Yard, down to Quantico, and they put it under the Marine Corps University. And I think that was the, you know, I don't think Colonel Ripley wanted to move to Quantico. He was still happy where he was at. So
let me tell you, he's a smart guy, and the commute between
a bit horrible.
The 95. And let me just tell you, to all you emergency people listening that work on Interstate 95. When there's an accident, get it the hell to the side of the road, man. What are you people doing sitting around smoking and joking while the rest of us are losing our minds? It's the worst. And I live now in Los Angeles.
Oh, it's worse in Los Angeles in some ways.
Oh, my God. It is. You know, it's that three lanes, and I know they've expanded it and they're continually working on it, but it is just a nightmare. So, once again, Colonel Ripley showing his smarts.
He did.
I love history. I love the Marine Corps. I will not do that.
That was a major factor. And so he retired. So the job was vacant for about a year. And then they did a series of interviews with a number of candidates. And I got on the short list. And I was hired by Major General Don Gardner in late 2006 as the next director of history. But it's now under new management, so to speak. It's a different organization than when Colonel Ripley had it. When Colonel Ripley was the director, they also had the museum. And what they decided to do in 2005 when they were getting ready to open the brand new National Museum of the Marine Corps, which is fantastic, by the way, if anybody's been out to this area and has not made a trip to see the National Museum, they definitely ought to put it on the itinerary because it is well worth the trip.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. Breathtaking.
Yeah, so basically, I get this position, but it's minus the museum's part. And so my job was is a brand new kind of reincarnation of the history division, which was to promote, publish, and preserve Marine Corps history. And so they were looking for a guy that had a Marine Corps background, but also had a doctorate. And you know, there weren't many of us.
Yeah, that's a short list.
It was a short list. And so there was a few, and there were some that had the doctorate that didn't have the Marine Corps background. There were some that had the Marine Corps background, you know, and other things, but they were looking for somebody that had both sides of the equation. And me and about maybe five or six other guys did. And I came and interviewed and ended up winning the position. And I got the job, again, came in to the job in 2006, and I've been here ever since.
My guest this morning is the director of history in the Marine Corps, the history division, Dr. Charles Niemeyer. And you've actually debunked the whole genius thing that I was going to ridicule you for during most of this interview. So I'm a little bit disappointed, I have to tell you, that I was going to tag you with genius and tease you the whole time, and now you seem like a relatively down to earth human being, which is disappointing.
That's that Baltimore background coming.
Oh my God! Hey, sir, we got to take a quick break. Can you hold on for a couple minutes?
Sure.
And then one question before we go to break. So you're the head of this. So do you get to go like into the vault and like put on Chesty Puller's helmet and stuff like that?
No, most of that stuff is in the museum. But I do get to see the original documents that are here in the archives and special collections. And we have commissions from officers that were commissioned in the War of 1812, and the signatures on the commission are Thomas Jefferson and James Madison.
And those are like real signatures.
Oh yeah, original signatures, and the commissions are just gorgeous, and has two presidents of the United States on there. One, of course, was the Secretary of State at the time.
Holy smokes. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue our discussion with the Director of the History Division, United States Marine Corps, Dr. Charles Niemeyer, and talk specifically about the controversy that came up about the Rosenthal photo and the iconic image of the Marine Corps, really. And one of the most published images in the history of photography and in the world. And yet the PAO guys screwed it up. So we're going to talk about that as we continue on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Nine minutes after 8 o'clock on the left coast of the United States, 11:09 on the east coast, where my guest is Dr. Charles Niemeyer, head of the History Division, United States Marine Corps, and we continue with our conversation. So let me ask you, when did this controversy about maybe somebody misidentified in this iconic image first cross your path?
Well, it was about 2 years ago. I was sent a copy of a news story that was done in an Omaha newspaper by a reporter named Matthew Hansen. And when I first got the news story, it was complete with a claim by two amateur historians, a guy named Eric Crelly and another guy named Stephen Foley. And these two, they're kind of buffs, and they looked at this Iwo Jima photo, and they looked at a lot of other photos, not just the flag-raising photo, but photos of people that are up there, and they were noticing some things about gear and the way it was worn and the way that it was positioned and so forth and so on. And so they kind of put forth an hypothesis that the guy that we had long identified as John Bradley was incorrectly identified, and that we had misidentified the corpsman of all people, and then we had him out of place, and we had actually another flag raiser was actually that person, and they were doing it via, you know, some grainy photographs, and I got a copy of it, and I got the newspaper copy, and I said, well, this is interesting, but I'm not ready to move forward with anything that we would be concerned about as far as having the lineup wrong. I said, well, it's it's very interesting, but it hasn't reached a, you know, critical mass yet, at least for me in my mind as an historian.
We're talking about the Vatican of the Marine Corps.
You're right. It's like the Last Supper.
Yeah, we are not jacked with this photo for
exactly. And of course, there's been claimants in the past. We've had a number of people claiming to be in the photo, and they don't have any corroborative evidence. And just the other day, I was looking at some oral history, and they were trying to say there was a third flag raising, and there's no evidence of that. So we have at least 8 large file folders of claimant information, that most of which is proven to be not correct or was debunked over the years. But in this case, this was a little bit more compelling, but we weren't ready to make the leap yet. And then about a year ago, maybe not even a year ago, probably last fall, Matt Morgan, a former PAO at the Marine Corps, who was associated with a television station out there, I believe in the West Coast. I'm not sure exactly where it is.
I think it's in Michigan. He was just on the air, and he was telling the story about how it first came to his attention when a prop manager talked to Sergeant Major Deaver on the set of Flags of Our Father and said, hey, this is Bradley in this picture, but this is him in the photo. And a goddamn prop manager? Are you kidding me?
They're looking at the gear.
Right.
The gear doesn't match up, and because I think the Sergeant Major Deaver was there as an expert on that area, and he's saying, I'm not seeing corpsman gear on this guy. I'm seeing something else. And again, it's talked about. It doesn't go beyond talk.
Well, because it's a corpsman. Look.
Right.
It's Bradley. It's the corpsman. His kid wrote a book. It's turned into a film. This dog is not hunting. Okay.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Right.
Thank you for the interest. The disabled guy in Ireland, you need to go find a job. And the other guy in Nebraska, you need to find something else to do, okay? But we are not going to mess with this image, and we can't touch the corpsman. He's untouchable. He's got to stay in the picture.
The feeling is that this had been looked at before, and I can tell you some background. That, you know, in 1946 and 1947, there was a controversy that was over the number one guy in the picture, and that was Corporal Harlan Block. They originally had misidentified him in 1945 when Rene Gagdon comes back from Okinawa, and I can give you the background on that really quickly. Because I have the documents right here at History Division. I saw a telegram that was sent from a newspaperman in Chicago to the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, around the 25th of March. And in this telegram, he says, wouldn't it be great, because this Rosenthal photo had come back and had gone kind of viral in 1945 terms, after it hit the newspapers, and they selected as the 7th War Bond Drive logo, the All Together Now poster is going to be made, and you see the iconic image with really not seeing the people very well. That was the whole powerful part of the image, was they're facing away. No one is known. It's an anonymous photo, but it's a team photo where it shows the Marine Corps raising a flag over Japanese soil, and we're going to take this to the finish, and we're going to win, and we're also going to do this by working together. And that was the message. And then it hits the United States, goes in every newspaper, and it becomes one of the more popular, as you know, photos in history. But what happens is this newspaperman says, wouldn't it be great to get all the survivors that are in that particular photo back here to help us kick off the War Bond Drive event. We're going to have it Soldier Field in Chicago, I believe, on the 20th of May, 1945. So President Roosevelt waits a couple of days and then sends a return telegram to this newspaperman editor and says, you know, that's a great idea. I've asked General Vandegrift, as well as the Secretary of Treasury, Theodore Roosevelt Gamble, to make it happen. And within 2 weeks, Roosevelt himself is dead. So he's going to die of a massive stroke at Warm Springs, Georgia on the 12th of April. But before that happens, the message goes out to the Marines, who have now ceased fighting on Iwo Jima, and they're preparing to retrograde back. Those who are left alive and not injured are going to retrograde back to Camp Tarawa in Hawaii. Many of the other Marines, it was a casualty, intense fight, 22,000 Marines killed and wounded, are sent to various hospitals, and they're all over the place, including John Bradley, who had been seriously wounded in both legs and was in the Naval Hospital in Oakland, California. So they say, well, who were these 6 guys? So the message gets back to the 5th Division, and it gets back to the 2nd Battalion, 28th Marines. The battalion commander, Chandler Johnson, had been killed during the battle. So many of the folks that were might possibly have information on who was there. But somebody then remarks, well, who knows who was in this picture? And Rene Gagdon volunteers and says, well, I know, because I was in it, and I know all these men well. So they said, good, you're getting on an airplane, you're going back to Washington, D.C., you're going to tell the public affairs office exactly who was in the flag, and we'll make sure we get everybody back. So while he's, before he gets on the airplane, Rene Gagnon gives five names, and he gives his own name, and he gives Sergeant Michael Strank, he gives, erroneously gives a guy named, Sergeant Henry O'Hanson, who was killed. He gives Ira Hayes. No, he doesn't give Ira Hayes a name. He gives everybody's name except for Ira Hayes, because Ira Hayes said, don't give him my name or I'm going to really hurt you bad. And
I think kill you was the
yeah,
operative.
He said that, or words to that effect.
Well, you know what? I had a Marine Corps gunner, Mike Musselman. I don't know if you know Mike, but Mike's a great guy. And Mike said, we were talking about this the other day. He said, you know, let me just tell you my experience in the Marine Corps. When a Native American Marine tells you that he's going to kill you, I would take that to the bank. He said,
well,
so
yeah.
I can't fault Rene Gagnon for doing that.
Well, so Gagnon gives every name but Hayes, and so he's the only one that's going to be back in Washington. He arrives back in Washington, D.C. around the 7th or 8th of April, 1945, and Bradley's in the hospital. And Bradley doesn't even know that Gagnon is naming him as a flag raiser. Gagnon says slowly the five names that he lists, and he lists Sergeant Hanson himself. He lists everybody, Sergeant Strank, Private Sousley, and he leaves out Hayes. And Lieutenant Colonel Hagenall, the public affairs officer, says, there's six guys here. Who's the sixth guy? And he says, well, I promised I wouldn't give up his name. And he says, look, the President of the United States wants to know who these people are. You're going to give us that name. And finally, Gagnon breaks down and says, okay, it's Ira Hayes. Immediately, a message goes back out, get PFC Ira Hayes back here ASAP. And so Hayes is going to be late in getting there. Meanwhile, the only source for who's in that flag raising is PFC Rene Gagnon. And Gagnon, you know, lists to the best of his memory who he thought was in the shot. And he lists John Bradley as being in the shot. John Bradley is, again, seriously wounded. He had been in intense combat. He's a Navy Cross recipient for actions that he performed before he climbed Mount Suribachi. So this guy has seen a lot of fighting and a lot of death and destruction for the 36 days there on that island. The flag raising is not the preeminent memory in his mind.
Right.
And so he does remember, we know this from the Flag of Our Fathers book, he does remember having something to do with the flag raising. That's, he writes a letter to his mother on the 26th of February, 1945, from Iwo Jima. They're still in the battle. You know, you may hear in the States about flag raising, and I had a little something to do with it. He doesn't even know about the Rosenthal photo. He doesn't even know it exists.
Wow.
So what we believe happened here is you know, there's two flag raisings, as we know.
Right.
One was raised at 10:20 in the morning, the first one. The one that everybody remembers, the one that everybody saw, that they were raising their helmets and throwing them in the air and cheering, and horns are blasting on Navy ships at sea. The flag is up on Suribachi. Suribachi is ours. That means the Japanese are no longer staring down our throats from the heights onto the beach, that we don't have to worry about that anymore. And that was a big moment. It's interesting to note, in all the documents that I've looked at on these flag raisings, everybody remembers the first flag raising time to the minute. It's 10:20 a.m. But I've yet to find a single document that says the exact time the second flag went up when Rosenthal took the shot.
Wow.
They all say, well, it was in the early afternoon. It was 2.5 hours later. It was 3 hours later. One even said 4 hours later. So that tells you that the second flag raising was a exchange of flags. The first flag raising is what's stuck in everybody's mind. And so when I think 2 months, or almost 2 months after the event, when they finally track down John Bradley in the Oakland Naval Hospital, and they show him a newspaper clipping of the flag raising, so you know that the clarity is not all that good. They say, hey, you know you're in this shot. And he says, I am. He says, well, I remember having a little something to do with raising the flag. Okay. So they fly him back to Bethesda. And you'll see pictures of John Bradley initially when he gets back. He's on crutches.
On crutches, yep.
So they then debrief him. They got Bradley and Hayes kind of arrive at the same time, and they then get together. They tell their story, and they're not real sure where they are in the photo at this point. They just know that they had a little something to do with raising the flag. And 2 days after they arrive, they're off to the races. They're 20th of April, they're meeting Harry Truman now, the new president of the United States, who had taken over for Roosevelt, and they have a personal meeting with the president, and then they go to the U.S. Capitol, and they raise the actual Iwo Jima flag over the United States Capitol. And then it's like one event after the other for the next 3 months. And in fact, Hayes doesn't even make it the whole time. Halfway through the tour, he has to leave and go back, just because it was too much for him.
My guest this morning from the History Division, the director, Dr. Charles Niemeyer, and we're talking about the controversy. And it hasn't been so controversial. It's simply a matter of evidence relative to the renaming of the Marines that were involved in the second flag raising, a working party, if you will, that became legendary as a symbol of American determination and has become really the image of the Marine Corps. Sir, can I ask you a favor?
Sure.
I'm supposed to interview a Marine tanker from the Chosin Reservoir in about 10 minutes. Can you come on back on in an hour? Does your schedule lend itself to that? Or
That will be what time here, Eastern Standard Time?
It would be, it's 8:30, it would be 9:30 Eastern Time.
No.
I'm 12:30.
12:30 Eastern Time. Okay, 12:30, I can do that.
Okay, all right. Then because the story, specifically I want to talk about, I mean, the weight really on you to be able to look at this. Now, all you PAO people, listen up. We're unscrewing the PAO community, okay, for the second time, okay? And we're in this, like, how can we screw this image up this badly? So you PAO guys, right, now the PAO, errors now fall on the artillery community to unscrew. Normally they fall on the infantry community.
To be fair, it wasn't all their fault. It was a whole
series
of errors.
When we're blaming the PAOs, they'll take it like men. But anyway... So now this controversy, and again, what I find ironic is Crelly is the guy who runs the 5th Marine Division webpage, yes?
Correct.
And then the guy in Ireland is just an interested guy who loves history, infatuated with the Marine Corps, gets some kind of injury in work, and he's laid up after hernia surgery or something like that, so he's got all this time on his hands, and they start looking at it. And I'm an Iwo Jima guy. I have, probably a couple thousand images. And I said, I've never seen that picture of Bradley on top of the hill, where it clearly shows, the kind of bandolier-style Unit 1 setup they had. And I looked at it, and I said, I've never seen that. Well, lo and behold, guess what? I started going through my pictures. Bigger than shit. Here's the picture. And you look at the picture, and it doesn't – it's like, if that's Bradley – then that can't be him in the photo. And here's my question that I find interesting. If I asked you to set up your war belt that you wore as an artilleryman today, do you think you could do that for me?
Yeah.
Exactly how you wore it?
Well, not exactly how I wore it. I probably would put things in a different position, but probably pretty close.
Pretty close, right? Because we as Marines, we focus on stuff like that, okay?
Yep.
You heard the Lieutenant Colonel talk about learning to spit shine his boots. We're crazy about that stuff. So to me, at some point, Bradley had to look at that and say, you know what? That can't be me because I never took my Unit 1s off. That's not the way I wore my gear. And so I find it interesting. I understand that, that he probably didn't know, and then he sees the picture and they say, no, you're in it. But I think as he looks at that, he has to look at that and say, that's not me. That's not how I looked.
There's a possibility it might have occurred to him. People take gear on, put gear off. They're up there for at least 2.5 hours between the flag raisings. And one of the things that I first looked at was that, well, people will probably take their gear off. There's not – once they first raised the first flag, they killed off the remaining Japanese that were up there. There was a little small firefight after the first flag went up. But after everyone went up, everybody else is fighting and dying and all over the island, but not on top of Suribachi. For that couple of hours, Suribachi is not a bad place to be once the Japanese have been killed by the first flag-raising party. They're now – it's a relatively calm area. They're only going to be up there for a few hours. They're going to get pulled down into the thick of it again, and that's where they're going to start taking casualties again, including Bradley himself, who gets hit. Strank and Block are going to get killed by shellfire within a week. And so it's a – temporary kind of lull in the intensity of what they've been facing.
Okay, now we're going to see the difference between the artillery community and the infantry community. See, the artillery community, they're busting out the ice chests and the folding chairs, right? And they're taking their gear off, right? The Marine Corps, right. The infantry guys, we're not taking our gear off. What are you? Hey, no, I know what you're saying, and you know what? And I believe that's plausible. However, I think this is just me now. I think that, you know, this whole thing rolls, and Bradley's a part of it, and I think over time he must have, again, because I know my gear. I know, and what's interesting is that the unique way it's Schmidt, right?
Which one?
Schultz.
Schultz, yes.
The unique way that he has his gear on is what contributes to identifying him, right?
Yeah, it does. That was a major factor.
And so it's incredible. Now, I just last question, and then let me hop and do the other interview. Chosen Reservoir Tanker. Like, do I have the best? I have kind of like a history division job, and that's what we do every day. We talk Marine Corps, we talk post combat related mental health, and having these guys on is like the most fun in the world because the stories they tell you sound like fiction. Carl Marlanis, Sebastian Younger, you know their stories and what they do. I want to talk about though. Last question before we go is your responsibility relative to the Marine Corps and this controversy because. It's probably about as visible as a Marine Corps historical division gets when it's international news about this story. So your responsibility relative to both your division and the Marine Corps.
Well, I can tell you my responsibility was to get the story right. And we only do that, obviously, after we've been given pretty strong corroborative evidence. We don't want to just – you know, be whipsawed by every rumor and every story that comes down the road. So what we got to do is we got to look at the evidence as it comes in, and we got to say, okay, this is plausible. We need to look into it. And one of the more important things was, and I got this straight from the commandant, he said, take your time, be fair, be accurate, and give me a reasonable response as to this evidence, whether it's correct or not. And that's exactly what we did. We formed a board of officers and senior enlisted members, and we put it together here at Quantico, and we remained in session for 6 straight days, and we came up with our opinions and findings of fact and presented it to the commandant last month.
And you were you charged with simply identifying whether Bradley was in or out of the photo and who it might be? Or
we were charged – not even that. We were said find out who we believe based on the physical evidence we could look at. And we looked at everything we could possibly look at. But we didn't look at anything that wasn't physically verifiable. And to come back with what we believe was an assumption and an opinion on who was in each single position. So we went from position number 1 all the way to position number 6, Ira Hayes on the end, and we listed the evidence that supports that person being in that slot. We did not want to replicate the mistake that was made in 1947 when it is focused on one guy.
PAOs, unbelievable. All right, when we come back, can we do that? And I just want to go through that evidence because I think this is, as a Marine, as a history guy, I'll walk through Marine Corps history. I've got an email for you, and then we'll let you go here for about an hour so you can have lunch.
Okay, sounds good. I'll be back at 12:30.
Okay, here's the email question. Sir, per your comments about John Ripley, in 1988, he spoke to the officers of the 9th Marine Regiment at the bequest of Colonel Tony Zinni. Colonel Ripley said, quote, if you want to be proud of just wearing a Marine Corps uniform, read Bill Ross's book, Iwo Jima, Legacy of Valor. I did, and it was superb. Incredible account of valor. Please tell me about some other books about Iwo Jima, USMC, or any subject that you have read and enjoyed, not necessarily maybe those on the reading list.
Well, I got Richard Wheeler's book when I was on active duty and read that. And he was a veteran of the battle. And another book that I just got recently was called In the Shadow of Sarabachi. And I can't recall the author's name. But these guys actually really worked on the photos and the images of combat on Iwo Jima. And I thought that was a very, very powerful thing. And then if you go to the History Vision website, www.history.usmc.mil, M-I-L, we have a key battle study stuff on the Battle of Iwo Jima that you might find interesting.
Give that website one more time.
It's www.history.usmc.mil. .mil. M-I-L.
SMC.mil. All right, I will look at that. Next question. You know what book I read that I found a great and a different read? It is Surgeon on Iwo.
Yeah, I've heard of that book.
It's not easy to get. You know, it's a Navy doctor's, you know, who's never been to combat before, view of the Marine Corps in this battle. And it's really interesting when he starts to pack all his stuff the morning of the landing. He says, this isn't all going to fit. I can't take all of this. And he talks about what he leaves behind. And then he talks about what he sees in the battle, which is absolutely incredible. Second question of the email. Two, the only book on Smedley Butler that I have read is Lowell Thomas's Old Gimlet Eye. Can you recommend any other titles?
There was a book, the biography that was written, by a guy named Merrill Bartlett, B-A-R-T-L-E-T-T, and I think it was called Maverick Marine, but that wasn't Bartlett's book. It was another book called Maverick Marine, and it was about Smedley Butler. A very controversial guy, as you know, double Medal of Honor recipient, kind of the old school, old core, pre-World War I type of Marine, which was a battalion size operations and smaller. And he basically, you know, was an interesting guy, didn't have a lot of formal education, came out of Philadelphia. His father, however, was the chairman of the Naval Committee. His name was Thomas Stalker Butler, and therein lies one of the reasons why Smedley Butler was very, very, cut a wide swath in the Marine Corps.
Wow.
And, but yeah, there's a Maverick Marine is one that I remember the title. And the other one, Merrill Bartlett's book on Butler was pretty good. But Merrill Bartlett was one of the better historians that I've met and known over the years. A former Marine Lieutenant Colonel, retired, lives out in the West Coast in Seattle area.
All right, sir. We will give you 60 minutes, and we'll call you back, and then we'll walk through the evidence that you guys assembled, your committee assembled, to validate each person. My guest this morning, sir, absolutely loved our conversation, and I'll give you a call back in about an hour.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Awesome.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. You bet. That is Dr. Charles Niemeyer. And here I was going to hammer him for being a smart guy, a genius. All right, we're gonna change gears. We're gonna take a break, about 2 or 3 minutes, and when we come back, we are going to talk to a veteran of the Chosin Reservoir. His name is Don Bennett, and living in Southern California. So we're gonna get him on the phone. We'll call him, and we'll talk about the Chosin Reservoir as a tanker. More of All Marine Radio. What a joke. This is the best job in the world. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Def Leppard here on a Wednesday. We continue. We resume an interview. Let me just tell you, this morning has been, if you're a Marine, I mean, it doesn't get a whole lot better than this. We're talking about the flag raising on Iwo Jima and the controversy that surrounds the Rosenthal photo and whatnot. Then we took a break and talked to Major Don Bennett, joins the Marine Corps, and his family leaves Oklahoma. And because his dad owned a hardware store. Listen to this, sir. The family owns a hardware store, but they can't get any more copper wire to wire the farmhouses now that electricity is prevalent. And they can't get any more pipe to run pipe for running water. So the father puts everything in storage. They move to San Diego, where he knows he can get employment. They move to Pacific Beach, which is farm country. And he goes camping as a Boy Scout in Claremont where they're raising cattle. Mm. And then he sells newspapers to Marines and soldiers, that are billeted around San Diego during the war. Joins Marine Corps in 1947, which he said was a pretty salty place. And then is a sergeant. I told you before we came on a little vignette about him signing a paper that the recruiter made him sign, saying that he understood that he'd be transferred to the United States Army if it was if it absorbed the Marine Corps. And then just the story of the 1st Marine Division and the brigade. He said, we didn't have enough guys. He said, you know, the companies of the brigade, they had two rifle companies. That's all we had. And their weapons companies, you know, wasn't a Philip Brown weapons company. And those are the guys that got on the boat and went, led by Raymond L. Murray.
Yes.
Two-time Navy Cross winner. Actually, three-time Navy Cross winner, if you count the Army's Distinguished Service Cross, which is the equivalent. And then four-time Silver Star winner in World War II in Korea. Incredible. And off they go, Chesty Puller sending telegrams to the commandant saying, bring me back and give me a regiment. And then he trains on the M4 tank at Pendleton. He's a tanker. And they give him the M26 tank, wider tank, smoothbore gun as opposed to rifle gun. And he didn't spend any time on it in the United States. The first time he saw it was in the well deck going across.
Amazing.
The Pacific, and he said, we learned to drive it in a baseball stadium in Japan. He said, we pretty much thrashed that thing. And he said, then they started welding snorkeling gear onto the tank. And we said, hey, what's that stuff for? And he said, don't worry about it. And he said, that's what I knew, that we were going to make a landing. And he said, so we leave for Incheon, and the 7th Marines had just arrived in Japan. He said, they were all getting drunk. Before, I said, I don't think you had to tell those World War II Marines what to do pre-invasion. And he started laughing. He said, you did not. They knew what to do. He said, hell, some of them were still drunk when they came ashore in Korea. And but the story, and we're going to continue the interview tomorrow because it's so rich in Marine Corps legacy, the parts of stories and the nuances, the oral history that you tend not to read about in larger works, but just fascinating Marine Corps history. So,
well, I can tell you a real quick sidebar that's related to that.
Sure.
The Marine Corps was hurting so badly for manpower. We had gone down to less than a division at this point in 1950, and when they needed the Marines, they literally stripped every single reserve unit that there was around the nation. And many of these reserve units had pullees or people who were waiting to go to boot camp. Well, when they activated these reserve units to feed them into the 1st Division getting ready to do the landing in Incheon, these reservists who had not been to boot camp went to Korea. And their OJT was fighting the North Koreans.
Why not?
And about 1,000 Marine reservists, we think, actually went into combat without ever having gone to boot camp. And at the end of the war, as they were getting ready to send them back home, somebody at headquarters Marine Corps said, well, you know, these guys never went to boot camp. We really ought to think about getting them down to Paris Island or San Diego.
No!
I kid you not. And they actually sent it up to the commandant, and the commandant says, are you kidding me? He says they've had their basic training for real.
At the hands of the North Koreans and the Chinese. I think we could let them off the hook on this one.
You just see some officer up at headquarters going, you know, they really got to get that boot camp check in a box.
Yeah, you know, if I was a commandant, I'd like, who is this guy, McNamara? send him down to me. He's done, that moron.
Well, they wiser heads prevailed, and they didn't have to go.
Wow. I'd never heard that.
Yeah, a lot of reservists. They got a little OJT firing their weapons on the ship on the way over, and some of the veterans were showing them how to break it down and field strip it and everything else. But it was close to 1,000 of them, if not even more. I can't remember the exact number, but it was a large number who had never attended boot camp when they went over.
Wow. It is an incredible story in terms of post-World War II history and the demilitarization of the nation in terms of, you know, peace in our time. And,
well, they all thought nuclear weapons were the answer. In other words, even General Omar Bradley said there'll never be a big operation like the Marines have been used to doing. And this is 1949, he says it, and just a year later, they do Incheon.
I meant at least not for another year.
Right.
All right. My guest is the director of the history division, United States Marine Corps, Dr. Charles Niemeyer. And, sir, let's begin to walk through the evidence that you guys compiled for the Rosenthal photo in terms of how you revalidated, in some cases, validated for the first time in others, each person in the flag raising. So you want to start from the front or the back?
We'll start from the front, and that person was initially identified as Sergeant Henry O. Hansen, and later they had a board that was convened at the behest of General Vandegrift, Commandant of the Marine Corps at the time in 1946, to find out exactly who this person was, because the family of Corporal Harlan Block, as well as Ira Hayes, one of the living survivors, had changed their story. They didn't believe that it was Henry Hansen anymore. Actually, I don't believe that Hayes ever changed the story. He always insisted, he just wasn't adamant about it, that the person in that position was Harlan Block and not Henry Hansen.
And in the movie, that's where the mother says she saw the picture and she said, that's his butt. I'd know that butt anywhere, right?
Right.
Is that all true?
That is true. She had written a letter to the commandant saying, I think that's my son, and I don't think you guys identified that first person right. And Marine Corps initially said, no, the survivors, meaning Gagnon and Bradley, both said, no, that's Henry Hansen. And Hayes tried to tell the PAO at the time that, I don't think that's Henry Hansen. And then Hayes was told, no, everybody's saying that's Hansen, and that's who it is, so we're going to go with that. But Hayes, it bothered him. And when he got out of the Marine Corps in 1946, he wrote a letter to the Block family saying, I agree with you that is your son. And then they came back to the commandant and said, you know, hey, you know, it's not just me that's saying this. And that's when the commandant says, you know, we got to get to the bottom of this. I'm tired of, you know, the questions of surrounding who is who. So as a result, he forms this board under Major General Pedro Duvalier, and they put together they get the survivors back again, and they call them in. They call the eyewitnesses in as best they can, and they look through the evidence they could, but they're not looking at everyone else. They're just looking at that number one guy, the guy closest to the base of the flagpole, as it's going up at the 45-degree angle. And so they, at that point, Bradley and Gagnon changed their story, and they say, you know, on second thought, after looking at the picture more intensely, we now come to believe that it is Corporal Harlan Block and not Sergeant Henry Hansen.
And what was Block to Ira Hayes? Were they in the same fire team? Were
they
in
the same
squad?
They were in the same squad. They were in Sergeant Michael Strank's squad of EZ-228. So these two guys knew each other real well. And Block, I've seen indications he was the assistant squad leader, although I've seen other indications that he was just another member of the squad. But Hayes and Block were in the same group with Strank as their squad leader.
And so, just a quick aside, Mike Strank, well, we can get to him in a second. So that's how Block is identified in this first commission.
Yeah, but not only that, we were able to look at several other post flag raising photos, and two things we noticed: as the flag is going up, there's a line across the back of the guy that's closest to the base of the flagpole. And that line, we were able to determine, was the strap for a bandolier of M1 ammunition. And then later on, in another photo taken after the flag has been raised and the men are trying to steady it and put it into the ground, there's four guys still on the pole, and the guy that was at the base is now standing upright, looking up at the flag, and you can see the outline of his face, and you can also see now the bandolier of ammunition in full view, and that's Harlan Block.
And that bandolier, it's high up on his left shoulder going underneath his left armpit?
Yes.
Okay.
And you can see the line. And when we blew the photo up, we were able to see that. And then when we turned around, we could see that this guy's face. And we looked at Harlan Block's boot camp photo. We looked at post-boot camp photos as well as this particular photo. We compared the facial profile with the actual photos of the other shots. And it clearly indicates it's most likely, I would say more than beyond a reasonable doubt, that it's Harlan Block.
All right. Who's next?
The next guy would be the number two guy, and that's the guy that's on the other side of the flagpole. And this is a tougher one because you never do get a good look. But that's where Rene Gagnon says he is. And we do get in the Bill Janaus film a brief glimpse of his face, as well as the fact that he is wearing an M1 rifle strapped to his back. So it can't be the corpsman. So he's, because he's a rifleman, and Gagnon was the battalion runner. And he was also a member of EZ 228, and he knew all the men, but he was actually assigned to headquarters as the go-between between the company and the battalion. And so you get a, you get to see a brief glimpse of his face in the Janaus film, the Bill Janaus movie camera film. And then you also get to see his rifle sticking up over his shoulder as it's strapped to his shoulder with a sling. He's more difficult to see, but you can see him. And that's where he says he is as an eyewitness, and that's where his it indicates it is a rifleman. And we looked at the face, although we could not get a as good a view of his face as this other block piece that we saw the post raising. Because what happens is after the flag goes to its perpendicular position, it's vertical now. Gagnon steps out of the shot, and he goes and starts gathering rocks to put at the base of the flagpole so it doesn't blow over. And that's one reason why we don't see any more of him in any more of the shots. But we're reasonably assured that that's Rene Gagnon based on where the eyewitnesses say he was, based on the fact that he has an M1 rifle in his back, and based on the fact that you can see a brief glimpse of his face, we believe, in the Janaus film.
All right. He's number two. Number three.
Number three guy is the guy that formerly we thought was John Bradley. That was the guy in the center of the photo. You can see the side of his face just barely in the Rosenthal shot, but not very well. And in this particular photo, we noticed, and by the way, you could see it in much clearer imagery today than you could back in 1945. That we have, you know, obviously contrasting and shading techniques today. You can, you know, you can enhance that photograph so you can actually really bring out what they're wearing on their person. And what we noticed is the gear on this person does not match the gear that John Bradley was seen in other photos wearing. Moreover, it's the gear of a rifleman, not necessarily a man who would be a corpsman. And what we see in the shot is a couple of things that we noticed was different from what the other shots that indicated was John Bradley. One was the tip of the peak of a soft cover, the brim, is sticking out from underneath his helmet. Both in this shot and in the post shot where there's four guys in the shot just holding the flag up and you can see the guy's face.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we see the number three guy has not moved from this position from the film, and we also see the still where he was located, and we also see the post raising flag still that was taken by Rosenthal as well. And we see a couple of things that are not right. There's a hat brim under the helmet. We see his trousers are uncuffed, with every other picture of John Bradley on top of the mountain shows him with very tightly cuffed trouser legs, and you can see his leggings underneath his trousers and his boondockers. And so you can see it. But you know, again, you can roll down trousers, but everybody in the flag raising shot has uncuffed trousers, and Bradley's trousers remain cuffed the entire time we could see him in all the photos up there. The other thing we saw, of course, Bradley wore suspenders on his web gear. This guy does not have suspenders on it. He has also rifle pouches, magazine pouches around his belt. He has a pair of wire cutters with the wire cutters still in the bag. He has a grenade launcher hanging from his belt. If you look at it very closely, you can see the grenade launcher attachment that goes to the M1 rifle hanging off the belt of this guy. It's clearly not the corpsman. And then the final most telling factor was this guy doesn't move from the position he's in, and Rosenthal takes another shot after the flag's already raised, and there's only four guys left, and they're hanging around the pole trying to get it steady and remain stable. And the guy looks up at this point, and you see his face, and it's Franklin Southsley's face.
Clearly.
Yes.
Wow.
And, of course, we had identified Franklin Southsley in the original photograph in 1947 as the guy in the number five slot, the guy with the rifle hanging off his shoulder.
Right.
So what the two amateur historians have done is they've moved Franklin Southsley from the number five slot to the number three slot where Doc Bradley was. And when I first was presented, you know, this theory, I said, well, okay, well, then Bradley's where Southsley was. And then I looked at the picture and I said, of all the guys in that shot, there's only one guy with a rifle that I can see clearly on his shoulder, and that's the number five guy, so it can't be Doc Bradley.
All right, let's go to the number four guy.
So number four guy is on the other side of the pole again, and that is Sergeant Michael Strank. Now, he's also probably one of the tougher ones to identify with physical evidence because you can't see his face ever. Not in the film, not in any stills, not in any. He is obscured by people on the other side of the flagpole, predominantly Southsley and other Marines that are there getting ready to raise the flag. And even after the flag is raised, we see his body there. We can see his hands wrapped around the pole. But one of the things we noticed about that particular hand shot that we were able to get on Michael Strank, and this is telling, is that John Bradley always wore a very large, looked like a class ring on one of his hands, and he had a Corman bracelet, I believe, on his right wrist. And in the shot, you can clearly see the hand of the guy in the number four slots wrapped around the pole, and you can see the separation between his fingers, and you can see the outline of his knuckles and fingers very, very clearly. The only thing you can see of that person, for the most part, you can't see much of his gear at all, and you don't see any ring. And we made we had the opinion that there's a lot of things you might change. You might change your gear. You might take things off. You might put things on, but you wouldn't take off your ring.
Yeah, you tend not to.
You'd
leave other things on your mind.
Right, and you would leave it on. And other shots, Bradley has the ring on the whole time.
Yeah, what is a Corman bracelet?
A Corman bracelet, I guess it was an identification that he was a Corman, and he had like a little, it looked like it was hanging off. It was like one of those like ID bracelets you'd see on people. Huh. And it was on his right wrist, and we can't see his wrist in some of these shots, but we could see the ring. And when we saw the hand of the number four guy, we don't see a ring at all. And in the film, here's something interesting we saw, and we debated this particular issue more than anything else. We looked at the film, and just as the flag is getting ready to be raised, it's not being moved up yet, but the Marines are lining up. The film starts, and there's four guys in the shot. There's only four. There's six guys on the pole eventually, but there's four guys. And we think Bill Janouse, the cameraman, who only has about 90 seconds of film in his camera. And he starts to film it, and it's clear that he thinks the flag is getting ready to go up. So he's starting the film, and then he suddenly realizes the flag's not going up. And you see the guys that are lined up on the pole, they're looking forward at somebody off camera. And we think that is Harold Schreier, the platoon commander. And he's timing the raising of the first flag with the raising of the second flag with the lowering of the first, so the Marines below don't believe that Sarabachi has been retaken by the Japanese. So the idea is to make a seamless switch. The first one comes down, the second one goes up. So he's going to time it, but not everything is all set up. And some of the photographers and even Janoust are grousing, "Hey, Lieutenant, when's this flag going up?" And Lieutenant Schreier growls at him and says, "It'll get up when it gets up." You can hear him now, Schreier's a former Raider. He's a tough guy.
He might have used some profanity in there.
Yeah, he might have
well.
Used a couple of words that were choicely made.
God bless Marines and attention to detail and our details, especially the ceremony, because, most people would not think about that. Yeah, take that one down. We'll put this one up. But Schreier very concerned that nobody misconstrued what was going on the top of that hill.
Right, and it was going to be quick. So it literally the action that takes place is a 5-second event when the actual flag goes up. But you can see the guys waiting, and so Janouse stops filming, and so we notice there's a break in the film. So I thought those old movie cameras that you'd wind up and then push a button.
Right.
Well, that's exactly what he had. So he's filming, and all of a sudden he says, "I don't want to waste my film. I only got 90 seconds while waiting for these guys to get their act together." So he stops filming, and then in that interregnum, two more guys get into the shot. The number guy and the guy in the number five spot, who we eventually going to think we believe, well, actually we're beyond a reasonable doubt sure that's Harold Schultz in the number five slot, and Rene Gagnon get into the shot. So now we got six. So he starts the film again. You can see they're ready, and you can see Ira Hayes's face very clearly. He's looking straight at the film camera, that's Ira Hayes. There's no doubt about it. So the flag goes zoop straight up. It's a 5-second act, and then as soon as the flag is up, the guy in the number five slot, the guy we now know to be Harold Schultz, goes out of the picture almost immediately. So he goes in late and he comes out early. So the only guy that would know he was even in the flag raising, I mean, that could physically see him, would have been Ira Hayes, who dies in I think 1957. And so this guy, that the mystery guy, is becoming less of a mystery to me, because the fact that he gets into the shot late, just before the flag is raised, he's the last one that kind of gets on the pole, and then he very quickly goes out of the shot and begins gathering rocks and putting them up at the base of the flagpole, as does Rene Gagnon. So the last two guys in are the first two guys out. and they go back to piling up rocks so the flag can remain stable. So the number four guy, we believe, is Strank. The number five guy is Harold Schultz, which I can kind of give you the details on him.
Go ahead.
Okay. Schultz has a number of anomalies in his uniform, in his gear. Number one, he has a broken helmet strap that's hanging off the top of his steel pot. Back in World War II days, they had a little leather strap that went across the top of the steel pot that held the helmet liner tight to the helmet itself. And it just clipped on with a little metal clip. And in Schultz's case, his was broken. So he has this little strap hanging down on his helmet.
And that's the strap that we see going across the bill of the helmet?
Correct.
Okay.
That's the one.
And it's just a little leather decorative strap, right?
But it holds. It has a functional purpose. It holds the steel pot to the helmet liner.
To the helmet liner. Okay.
Right. And so bottom line is that it's too small to be a chin strap. And so it's clearly the helmet strap, but Schultz is the only one who's walking around on top of the hill in other photographs where he's identified as Harold Schultz with that particular strap. And you can even see the outline of that strap in the Janaus film. Not real clearly, but you can see it's a strap hanging off the helmet. Other shots, you see it as well. He's in a foxhole. He's got the helmet strap hanging down. Another one where he's walking around with his rifle. He's got the helmet strap hanging down.
Why the hell didn't he take a knife and cut the damn thing off? That would drive anybody else crazy.
Well, you know, Harold Schultz, if you look at Harold Schultz's way he worked, he's every unit kind of has a guy that, you know, personal appearance is not his priority. I mean, he's in combat, you know.
He's that guy?
Yeah, he's that guy. He's the guy that's like, he's got a hole in his jacket, his gear is kind of all disheveled, he's got stuff in every single pocket. He's kind of, I don't know, he looks a little scroungy, but he's, remember, he's fighting the Japanese,
right.
And he's in close combat, and he doesn't care what he looks like.
You know, the other thing I love about, you know, modern-day Marine Corps versus World War II Marine Corps, you can't find a picture of any two guys dressed alike on Iwo Jima or most of the Pacific, right? Their hair is long.
Oh, yeah.
Their shots that they take, you know, in their dress blues, their hair is long. Their covers are tilted to the side.
Mm-hmm.
How we got this craziness about uniformity, I'm not exactly sure. But
it came out in the 50s.
If you look at our heritage, we are a stylish group. And we tend to dress the way we want in combat.
Yeah, these guys did. And Schultz, interestingly, he has another anomaly about his gear, and that's his rifle. And that was probably the very, very strong piece of evidence in that his rifle is slung on the stacking swivel because his upper handguard sling swivel is missing or broken. I'm not sure. We looked at it and we couldn't tell, but
it clearly
isn't there.
Sir, could you explain, for those not familiar with the M1 Garand, could you explain how the sling works and the fact that there's two swivels so that makes sense?
Right. There's one at the butt, so it basically holds the bottom end of the rifle, and it's looped through this sling swivel that's down towards the butt of the weapon itself. And there's one about three-quarters of the way up on the upper handguard stock, which is the little wooden piece that goes underneath the barrel and assembly that goes towards the muzzle of the weapon. And then just towards the top of the muzzle, there's this little clip, and it's not even a complete clip. It's like a U-shaped clip that it goes up there. And what it was designed for, when you're in camp or you're in garrison, you could stack arms, and you would have Marines that would basically go into these, you know, pup tents or whatever they would, and they would stack their arms outside the tent in groups of three or four sometimes. But the stacking swivel would be utilized to kind of link them together so they wouldn't fall over. Well, in this case, because Schultz's weapon was missing the upper handguard sling swivel, he has to move his sling further up the barrel to almost towards where it's at the muzzle, and he has to loop his sling through this stacking swivel clip, which makes his weapon hang weird. So when he's trying to raise the flag, we see this Marine trying to raise the flag with his rifle slung in this fashion. It looks like the rifle's coming off his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rene Gagnon has his rifle slung properly with the upper handguard swivel, and that rifle is tight to his shoulder. It's straight up, and it's vertical, and it's not hanging off his shoulder. But in this case, because Schultz's is broken, he can't hold it there, so it flips off to the right side. So it's almost like it's coming off his shoulder over and over again. And he's the only one on the hill of any other photos we have that has his rifle slung in that fashion.
Because
he happens to be the number guy in the number five slot.
Because he's that guy. So really, Schultz is, relative to Strank and Gagnon, Schultz is, sounds easy to identify because of the unique features of the way he wore his uniform, the way he slung his weapon. He sounds like one of the easier guys to identify.
He was easy once you look at the other shots, but nobody put two and two together until these two amateur historians start to work on this thing, and they really take their time and look at hundreds of shots, and they kept coming back to that. What is that thing on his helmet? What is that thing on his helmet? And then they said, what's wrong with his rifle? How come his rifle's hanging weird? And they're the ones that asked the question two years ago.
Wow. Now, Ira Hayes, in his initial statement, who does he say? He says that Sousley, because do you think because that Schultz joins the photo late and he knew Sousley was standing in front of him? How did Sousley get to be named where Schultz actually is?
Well, I think that Gagnon is the one that identified most of the positions of people. But even the initial I'm recalling from memory, and I wish I had them in front of me, but I recall the original documents where they gave their statements. And I believe Hayes had misidentified himself when he first looked at the picture. I think he thought he was the number five guy. He thought he was the guy with the weapon on his shoulder. He says, I know this because I always carried an M1 carbine. And then somebody said, well, that's not an M1, a carbine, that's an M1. And he goes, oh, well, then that's not me. And then he says, well, I think I'm this guy now. And then he figures out he's number six. Gagnon himself has some difficulty locating himself because he's on the other side of the flag and he can't see his face. So
right. It's
real hard back in 45, 46. Oftentimes they were given a newspaper photo to look at.
Yeah.
And they're saying, tell us where you are in the shot. And you can't see faces. All you see there are backs, and it's smudged and grainy and pixelated. And they take a guess.
I have an email question for you.
Sure.
Mac, what an interesting Marine Corps history conversation. Where was the original film that could have been developed into a much better image that these guys could have looked at? Did Rosenthal retain that? Did that get transferred to the Marine Corps? What happened to the original image?
Well, the original image was owned by AP Press, and because Rosenthal was an AP news reporter.
Okay.
Now, so AP retained the original photo, but we have a pretty good image of it. The problem is when you make a copy of that original image, it's copied and then copied
right.
again and then copied.
Right.
And as you succeedingly make more copies, it gets worse and worse. But the original image was retained by AP News, and it was their photo and it was their property.
And where is that now? Do they still own it?
I believe they. It may be. I don't know if it's in the National Archives or it's in the Smithsonian. But I don't know. It might still be an AP. I really don't know the answer to that question. But I do know that our copies are really, really good today because we were able to use our advanced, reprocessing and imagery to really bring out the details that we needed to look at. So when I'm looking at this photo, I'm looking at a much better photo as far as its shading and contrasting than the survivors had to look at.
My guest, the director of the Marine Corps History Division, Dr. Charles Niemeyer, a retired lieutenant colonel of artillery-type Marines. And now that is the appropriate term, just so you know, sir. Artillery Marines, not artillery men. You know what? I said this morning, like, to me, much ado about nothing. You know, there's a lot of men on the planet, half the population. There's not a lot of Marines. Anytime you can upgrade man to Marine, to me, that's a win for us. So I'm okay with it.
Well, since I was a Marine, I have to agree with you.
All right. There you go. Exactly. All right. Let's talk about Ira Hayes and identifying him.
Sure. Ira Hayes is identified through I found him the easiest one. He's in the Janaus film. He looks up several times. He looks towards the camera once or twice. You can see it's his face. Then you also see he's got an M1 carbine on his back. There are two guys that we believe carried M1 carbines that are in the shot. One is Michael Strank, who you cannot see with his carbine, and the other one is Ira Hayes, and you can see his carbine in a couple of the shots, as well as the movie, just briefly. But the best thing about that movie, the Janaus film, is that you can see Ira Hayes look up, and it's his face.
So he's the easiest.
I think he is. I think he was the easiest one because he's the only one that's looking up before the flag goes up. The rest of them are looking down and getting the flag ready to go into the ground and are looking away. Hayes in the movie it looks over and glances at Janaus, and Janaus films him.
All right. So you go through all of this, and on the other side of it, you're obviously very comfortable, it sounds like, saying that, look, after all the forensics that we've done, we can now say conclusively that this is, these are the Marines in this photograph.
Correct.
Now, Schultz has become, you know, he comes home, and now the kind of the mystery that surrounds the image itself. I could put my war belt together that I wore when I was lieutenant captain without too much trouble today. And so while I think Bradley could, you know, not recollect whether he was in the image or not, I don't think when he's staring at that sculpture, the day of its dedication, and he's looking up at it, and he sees the guy who's supposed to be him, I just don't believe. I think he looked at that and said, yeah, that isn't me, but this is so not worth it. I'm not going to rock the boat. I'll go up and do what I do up in Wisconsin, and I'll never speak about this again. And so he bears a tremendous burden. But to me, the other guy that's absolutely fascinating in this is Schultz. He comes home, he becomes a mailman because of his disability and gets hired there, and he never, ever, you know, seeks to write the record, and he's very content to just live out his life.
Yeah, he is, and it's a very interesting kind of turn of events. One reason why guys like Schultz and perhaps even Ira Hayes don't want to be known as a flag raiser is kind of twofold. One is, if you become identified, suddenly the focus is on you, and Iwo Jima never leaves you. You are going to be brought back to that fight over and over and over again. And it's not something that a lot of these guys wanted to do. It was horrible enough to have experienced it. Yet if you're going to make me relive it constantly, every day for the rest of my life, that's not something I want to sign up for. And the other thing I think that bothered them, and you can see this even with John Bradley in some of his testimony that actually when he's asked about it after the war, they said, well, you're a hero. And he says, no, we're not. And we're not heroes. In fact, I believe the daughter of Harold Schultz said that the only time that she remembers in her lifetime, and again, Harold Schultz doesn't get married till he's 63, so he's only going to be married for the last 7 years of his life. But Harold Schultz lives a solitary life. He's very quiet, according to his daughter, stepdaughter, a very kind man. And she mentions to him at the dinner table one day, you know, he mentions at the dinner table just in passing. In fact, it was so random in passing that his wife doesn't even comment on it. And he said, you know, I helped raise that flag. And she said, well, Harold, this means you're a hero. And he says, no, I'm not a hero. I'm a Marine. And that tells you a lot, I think, about the attitude of not just Harold Schultz, but about a lot of the Marines. And he said, you know, don't call me a hero. They don't feel like heroes, you know, for having survived Iwo Jima. And they remember the guys that were heroes, guys like Michael Strank and Franklin Sousley and Harlan Block, who didn't come home. And they had a little, you know, a little guilt that people were buying them drinks and calling them a hero because they touched a pole. They were heroic men. Don't get me wrong. All of them were, because especially they're going to go on to do incredible things later on in the battle. They got 30 more days of fighting to do. At the end of the day, they don't feel good about people making a big deal out of them for having raised a flag. They would rather get on with their lives and move on. But here's what they do. I believe, you know, they realize they got to sell war bonds. And, you know, they want us to go out and go to Soldier Field. We'll go to Soldier Field. And they were told, you know, this isn't as important as fighting a battle in some ways. We're fighting the economic fight to bring this war to a successful conclusion, and you're going to become a big part of that. And you need to get out there and do your duty. And that's the way that generation was.
Right.
They didn't push back. They said, what do you need me to do? We'll do it.
My guest, the director of the History Division, United States Marine Corps, Charles Niemeyer, and doctor type, PhD. Don't hold that against them. and we're talking about the evidence that was accumulated in order to get to ground truth on the flag raising on Iwo Jima. A couple questions. I almost think that the quote you just said of Schultz's ought to be etched in the base of that. No, I'm not a hero. I'm a Marine.
It sums it up, doesn't it?
It does. And you know, you see the pain. In fact, I interviewed Staff Sergeant Jeremiah Workman, one of the best interviews I've ever done in my life, and not certainly because of me, but because of him, Navy Cross winner in Fallujah, and you know, and he didn't feel good about his Navy Cross. I mean, they killed 24 insurgents that day. They lose three Marines, and he wrestles to this day with the fact that not being able to get to those guys quick enough, he feels, you know, he made mistakes, and he lives with that. And now this Navy Cross has made me a celebrity for something that I don't feel good about.
Right.
And I asked him, I said, when you saw Flags of Our Father, and you saw those guys meet the mothers of Mike Strank and Sousley, I think his mother's there, and I don't think the blocks don't get there, but when you see that scene, and he said, oh, I totally identified with it, and how uncomfortable they are being called heroes and all of that, he says, totally identified with it. And then I said, what about, and then he talked later in the interview about his drinking, and I said, so let me take you back to the movie. You see Ira Hayes, who gets called a hero repeatedly in his life, and obviously doesn't. He goes. I write about him in my book.
Mm.
I totally identify with the burden that you carry by becoming a celebrity by something that you're not good with. And as you said, sir, they walked up there as a working party.
Yep.
To replace a flag, and then are held up and. And I want you to, can you talk a little bit about Mike Strank? Because one of the most emotional scenes in the book is when every one of them, you know, when Mike Strank's name comes up. Talk to us about who Mike Strank was and what he was for these guys.
Michael Strank was a combat Marine, and they all respected him. I mean, everybody that I read all the documents that related to how they interacted with him, everybody talked about his just valor in combat, his leadership ability. He's a Marine's Marine. He's a sergeant, and he's got things well. And he's been in the Marine Corps for a little bit longer than some of these other guys. I think he joins in 1939. He was actually born in Czechoslovakia, but he said he was from Conemaugh, Pennsylvania, around the Pittsburgh area. Typical, you know, immigrant family working, you know, in the Pittsburgh industry of steel and coal and iron. And he joins the Marine Corps as a young man, and he makes his way up the ranks. We were able to get a copy of his official record. I have to tell this funny aside, and I don't think it's violating any privacy here, but he got in trouble one time for butchering a cow without orders. That's the first time I ever heard of that offense. But apparently they were at in Hawaii in a training for you know, Iwo Jima, and he ran across a stray cow, and he decided it was some good hamburgers could be made.
That's incredible.
Apparently they did this cow in, and then farmer must have complained and got Strank in trouble.
Unauthorized
butchering of a cow.
No, but everything you read about him and how emotional Hayes got whenever he spoke about Mike Strank.
They all do. I can tell you a lot of those guys. I just read something just the other day, and I never ran across it before. It was a oral history from a Marine who said he was wounded, and he went down to the battalion aid area where they actually had a med unit working on the seriously injured who they're trying to save guys. And their battalion commander, Chandler Johnson, had been hit mortally, as it turned out. And he was brought in, and the surgeon just frantically trying to save this lieutenant colonel's life, and he couldn't do it. He eventually bleeds out, and he dies on the table. And this Marine says, he came in and saw Johnson laying there, and I then looked up and I saw the surgeon walk away, and the surgeon was crying, tears running down his face, and he said he'd never seen that before. Because usually the surgeons are got a pretty tough high because they work on so many casualties. But in this case,
mm-hmm.
It's so upset that surgeon he had to walk away, and he was weeping because he couldn't save the life of Chandler Johnson.
You know, there's a great we talked about how crazy, you know, Marines of World War II wore their uniform. There's a picture of Chandler Johnson at the base of Suribachi. It looks like at his battalion CP with his soft cover on, and the bill is turned up, right? It looks like Gomer Pyle.
And like Hank Bauer.
Yeah, who the hell's in charge of this group?
Well, he was a stocky guy, and he was an interesting guy, but they thought the world of him. He, tough guy, had everything under control. A lot of battalion commanders killed him, a lot more than any other battle. They were going through battalion commanders. Like, I mean, at the end of the fight, many battalions are led by captains.
Wow. Wow. Email question for you. Mac, what an interesting discussion this morning. Only Marines, I'm sure, are listening, because everybody else would think, who would waste this much time on something like this? But for us, it's our lifeblood. The colonel spoke of a web page. Is the report that was issued, and I've read there's one, but I've never seen it, is that report on that website that he talked about? How did
the 1947 report is on the website, but the latest report, the one we just did, we've just given it to the commandant, and so we're waiting to get permission back from headquarters to put it on the website, and the commandant's got to do some things, notifications to some folks and that sort of thing.
Wow.
Once that's done, then we'll get the word from on high that we can put it on our website. So it should be there in a few weeks.
Okay. And so what else would – but the first investigation is on that site?
Well, the board report itself.
The board report.
The Duvalier board is on that website, yes.
Okay. Well, and what else – so – what will we find on that page? So let me get to it here.
The Duvalier report?
No, just the page you sent us to. So I'm at it now. Frequently requested, conducting in-person research, publication, information for units, internships, Marine Corps Order 57, 51, Task 1 Hotel. So talk to us about the Marine Corps History Division, this main page. And for those of us who are avid history people or at least Marine Corps history people, what do we find there?
Well, you're going to find basically about everything that the History Division has published since 1919.
Wow.
We've been able to upload that onto our website. And so if you want to learn about Marines in World War One, it's there. If you want to learn about the Battle of Saipan, it's there. So there's a lot of good stuff on history located on that site. You can click on the you can get a PDF of the publications. And the other thing that we do is we do frequently asked questions. We get a lot of questions about the Iwo Jima battle, obviously. We get a lot of questions about the flag raising. Sometimes they'll be listed there so you can get an answer very quickly. And we'll have things that we'll put and we'll hang on the website that we could, because people want to know about it. And so when we began getting a lot of questions about the identities of the second flag raisers, we decided to put the Duvalier report up there. This is before we got the compelling evidence that were produced by the television group out there, as well as two amateur historians. We said, look, the survivors would know who was in the shot, and this is what they said. And we actually have the handwritten testimony of Ira Hayes, and it's in his handwriting. It's not typed. We have the handwritten testimony.
And that's in that PDF.
And it's in the PDF, and
wow.
We have a handwritten testimony from Ira Hayes to Mrs. Block. We have the memorandum from the Division of Public Information Headquarters, Marine Corps, that talked about, you know, the interviews and gives us point by point when Gagnon has talked to. And one of the greatest things, I'm looking at this thing, and it says here, realizing that Gagnon had already named four men, which including himself only totaled five, were in a close study of the picture revealed that there were six. I asked him to give me the names again, only this time to jot them down. I handed him a pencil and a piece of scrap paper, just like an interrogation. And then Gagnon wrote Strank, Bradley, Southley, and Hansen. And at my suggestion, he then added his own, a total of five. It was then I asked him for the name of the sixth man, pointing with a pencil to the six figures. Gagnon studied the photograph closely for several minutes, finally admitting that there were six in the picture. I again asked him for the name of the sixth man, but Gagnon only stared down at the picture. Finally, after further questioning, he said he knew the sixth man but could not name him. I asked him why. After further hesitation, Gagnon said he had promised not to give the man's name as he did not want to be identified. In fact, Gagnon was visibly upset. Realizing he was fresh from combat, nervous and under strain, I reasoned slowly and deliberately with him, insisting, however, he would have to name the other man due to the many factors connected with the picture, especially his return stateside under orders. Sometime later, Gagnon very reluctantly stated that the sixth man was an Indian, and he was known as the chief. His name was Hayes, Private First Class Ira H. Hayes, Company E, 2nd Battalion, 20th Marine Regiment.
Wow.
That's how he did it.
Marine Corps history.
We had that stuff. We had all that stuff written down, and of course we put that on our website so that when people came in, I said, "Look, this is what the survivor said," and it says here in 10 December we have a document here, and it lists it says here as a participant of the flag raising on Mount Suribachi, photographed by Joe Rosenthal. I make the following identification of those seen in the picture. He goes, 1, Franklin Southley, 2, Rene Gagnon, 3, Mike Strank, 4, pharmacist mate John H. Bradley, 5, Corporal Harlan Block, 6, PFC Ira H. Hayes. And he signs it, Ira Hamilton Hayes. And this is on the 10th day of December 1946. So all the survivors say Bradley is in the shot.
And, you know, and the one thing, I look, John Bradley, this in no way besmirches him in any way. I mean, it's confusion. You know, you in the Navy, and first of all, we as Marines know the elevated place that we place our corpsmen in to begin with. Like, you can screw with any Marine in the platoon.
Don't mess with the doc.
You mess with the doc, right? There's going to be a fight quicker than normally that's going
to
happen.
Nobody messes with the doc. They don't make the doc do anything the doc doesn't want to do.
Exactly. And, you know, some of the most courageous, and now, you know, I mean, this station is dedicated to post-combat related mental health. And this issue is filled with it. Ira Hayes, you know, never gets over it. You know, and you know, John Bradley, you talked about, you know, his recurring nightmare with his buddy Iggy. Mm-hmm. And so you see it pregnant in this image, post-combat related mental health. And so corpsmen, you know, it's one thing to work on somebody that you don't know. It's another thing when you're trying to save the life of a friend.
Yes.
And the horrific, intimate experience that is for those who have to do it. And they don't die in, like John Wayne's, oddly enough, in the sands of Iwo Jima, where you get shot and you tip over, like, most of the time. They are screaming, please don't let me die. You're friends with them. You're trying as hard as you can. They're trying as hard as they can to live, and it doesn't work. And to the corpsman that survived something like Iwo Jima to win the Navy Cross, in no way, shape, or form does this re-identification of this working party turned icon diminishes what he did on that island or what he did in his life. And so, you know, I know there's been much discussion about that, and his son, you know, obviously agrees with the work that you all have done, sir. But John Bradley's still an incredible man, incredible Navy corpsman, in support of the Marine Corps on that volcanic island.
That's exactly the way we see it. We just believe that because of the time that passed between when their flags were raised and his memory, he conflated his role in the first flagging with that of the second, and he really didn't focus on it very closely after that because he was off to the races with the war bond drive, and then after that it was other things, and nobody ever really focused in on that particular position until later. And if he knew about it, he didn't say anything to anybody. We never got any inkling. And nobody else really wanted to do it, I guess, open that kind of book either, because they had this investigation. The commandant slapped the table, as did General DeValle, and said, these are the guys in the shot, and everybody agreed.
And you know what? Given Bradley, the way he comes back, and then you know, talking to Lieutenant Colonel Matt Morgan the other day, he said, you know, Bradley was met and he was asked, is this you? And, you know, as you relayed earlier, is this you? These guys say it's you. It's, you know, yeah. And then it's like, I'm not going to turn over this whole thing. And this is just me thinking that him sitting there at the dedication, looking at that thing and saying, that's me. That's not me. I mean, that's not my equipment. That's not how I was dressed. That's my whole time there. I was dressed different. But you know what? I'm not going to put my family through this. I'm not going to put myself through this. I'm not going to put these other guys through it. So be it. And I think very much at peace in doing that in terms of wanting to turn the page. I don't want to go back there. And this thing is so hysterical that I'm not touching it. And I can totally understand that.
Right. I can tell you another thing that about the DeValle report. The day the DeValle report is released, General Vandegrift, Commandant of the Marine Corps, writes a letter to the Hansen family to tell them that we don't believe Sergeant Hansen is any longer in the shot. And it was very embarrassing both to the Commandant personally and to the Marine Corps to have to tell a Gold Star mother that your son is not in a very famous photo. And it was tough, you could tell. And I think that's the reason why Vandegrift wanted to get to the bottom of it, and that's why you put a major general active duty, the former division commander of the 1st Marine Division, in charge of the investigation. And he says, let's get to the bottom of this once and for all. So it was a kind of that once and for all attitude. Was once they did the investigation in 47, everybody was, this is it. This is the final word. And it remained the final word for the next 70 years. Until these amateur historians began to say, you know, one on one doesn't match up here. There's something, these anomalies, there are just too many of these anomalies that are saying that they got it wrong the first time when they did the investigation. So, you know, Sergeant Hansen's family, you know, had to get informed by a courier from the commandant's office and a personal letter written by Vandegrift himself, Medal of Honor recipient on his own right. And it was embarrassing to him to have to do that. But he did it. He said, we have to do it to get it right.
So is there anything that has transpired in this that, you know, maybe isn't in the documentary or maybe I'm not smart enough to ask that has touched you in either a personal way or professional way that you'd like people to know?
Yeah, two things. Number one, just like you just said, John Bradley, this does not diminish his reputation at all. He is on that hill. He is on that patrol. He does his duty until he gets hit where he can't do it anymore. He is an incredible American, and I wish that everybody could emulate the way he lived his life and how he performed in combat. It was just unbelievable. So I believe that it doesn't change the narrative of the raisings. He was involved in the first flag raising for sure. I got his hand on the pole at least two times in two different photos. And he was a participant of the flag raising event in some fashion, either helping to plan it or steady the pole or whatever it is, because I have those photos right here. The other thing that I think is important to understand is that, you know, we now know the significance of that, you know, how that generation viewed you know, their role in combat. They were very, very much, different, I think, in many ways from, you know, people who did not want to be, you know, you don't want to be known for things. They wanted to keep it quiet. They just wanted to get back to the United States. They wanted to live. They wanted to return home. They wanted to get their lives restarted again. They wanted nothing to do with, combat or going back, and to that, awful island that they just got off of. They considered themselves very fortunate to have survived, and they felt a little guilty about it. And as a result, you know, this is important to understand, is that that generation does not want the notoriety. And if you ask any of those flag raisers, if they had to do it over again, would you like for your name to be known that you raised a flag? I would say about five of the six would have probably said no.
Who would have said yes?
I think Gagnon would have.
Interesting. Colonel Morgan said that his son, you know, relayed that, you know, he thought that that his father was treated unfairly in the Flags of Our Father movie,
I think he was too.
That he was happier, you know, he was, you know, that this was somehow an opportunity for him where the rest of them didn't, that he was treated unfairly in that way.
I think he was too. I think that he didn't mind, at the beginning, you know, saying, yeah, I was involved and I know who was involved and I know the men very well. And he actually says that. But I think once he got into the folderol of identity and then misidentity and everything else, I think he came to regret it. And, in other words, maybe he would have changed his mind about volunteering. I think at first he would have said, I don't mind being known. But I think after all is said and done, they probably would have all said, that's okay. I'll take a pass on this.
You know, and it is Schultz's behavior is Hayes I would accept because of his you know, his post combat related mental health conditions and that link to alcohol. But Hayes, Bradley and Schultz behave in the exact same manner.
Yeah.
They leave it behind and they want to move in life. And if you can imagine, how the hell do you leave Iwo Jima behind?
You don't get reminded of it. You, and that's what the flag raising does to you. It constantly brings you back over and over again. And, you know, every time you turn around, there's another newspaper and the anniversary of Iwo Jima, they want to talk about it, or there's another reporter knocking on your door. And so eventually, I think there was a story that I heard that John Bradley had trained his kids to say, hey, tell them I'm gone fishing.
Right. And you could imagine for him, I mean, like I said, I know how intimate our gear is to us and how we do it. And if you looked at that and said, you know what, I don't want to go back there for a bunch of reasons. And it's just an interesting story. So first of all, I want to thank you for taking the time this morning to sit down and talk here to everybody at All Marine Radio. And, this will go up as a YouTube, video later on today. And so I hope you don't mind down the road if I bug you on occasion to talk about different.
It's All Marine Radio, and I'm the Marine historian. You better, like I said, if you have a question, you better call us.
I love that. Well, you know, we're good when the Commandant was the first guest.
Well, you know, General Neller, it should be at one point I'd like to make, if you don't mind.
Sure.
General Neller has been tremendously supportive of this effort to get the story right. He was very patient with us, but he was very direct in that. He says, get it right, take your time, and get me a report that I can look at and agree with. And the bottom line was is that we went there and we said, you know, we're going to say all the things we can know and what things we can't know and let the Commandant see everything, warts and all. But he said it's important that we get it right for not just posterity, but for the Marine Corps as well. Like I said, I can't say enough about the support of General Neller.
Walking in General Vandegrift's shoes.
Sure was. He's a very comparable position, and he does the exact same thing that General Vandegrift did in 1947.
And you know what? Very similarly, whose son writes the book and that a movie's made about?
Yes, of course, it's James Bradley, right?
Yeah, I mean, it had to be Bradley, right? It couldn't have been somebody else's kid.
When I saw the evidence and I said, they don't think the corpsman's in a shot. I said, of all people, come on. You know, I said, there's five Marines and a corpsman, and you're gonna say the corpsman's not in the shot. I mean, that's the Navy Marine Corps team writ large right here, you know. And I said, that's why I was very, you know, upset when I first heard the story. I hadn't seen any evidence yet. But I first heard a story that they were making this claim, and I said, come on. I said, how long are we going to do this? I mean, we've gone 70 years with the corpsman in the shot. Now he's not, you know. And so that's, from an historian's point of view, we took the old Missouri, you know, motto, show me the evidence. And actually, they did. The thing of it is that they sent not one, but two photographic forensic studies to me. And each one corroborated the other one. The last one they sent me around the New Year's, actually it was first week in January I received it, was from a Canadian outfit that was headed up by a forensic expert named Michael Plaxton. So he really doesn't have a dog in the fight. He's not an American citizen, he's a Canadian. And he says he concurs with the first, not only does he concur with the first forensic study that was done by a Los Angeles outfit, But he adds more to it. It's a 54-page detailed analysis of all the photos, and he concurred with Crowley and Foley's original hypothesis.
Email question for you, sir.
Sure.
And then we'll let you go. Although I don't want to. I'm enjoying the conversation. Email says this. Mac, has the doctor seen the upcoming Smithsonian production? And if so, what does he think of it?
I haven't seen it in its entirety. I just been allowed to see clips. They filmed me for it, but just briefly. Commandant, I believe, was filmed, and a few other Marines were filmed. I think it's very fair. For the parts that I've seen, it's very fair. I don't think you're going to get any revelations which haven't already reached the print or even radio. Mm-hmm. Like we're talking about, there's nothing new there that's going to come out. The biggest thing is that the heretofore unknown Marine, Harold Schultz, is in the shot, and that John Bradley is not, and Franklin Sousley is in a different location than where he was originally located, but he's still in the shot. But we believe in the report that comes out that John Bradley made an honest mistake about confusing his role in the second flag raising with his role he played in the first, and that's why we got the confusion initially, and it carried on through the years because nobody else bothered to look at it very closely afterwards because the value report was so definitive, we believed at the time. So that's the upshot of the documentary.
All right, sir. First of all, we will do this again on I don't know another issue, but I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you very much for taking over an hour and a half out of your time today.
Oh, thanks, Mac. I appreciate it.
All right, sir. Have a great day.
Take care. Bye.
All right, there you have it. I like this job from the Marine Corps History Division, Dr. Charles Niemeyer, PhD from Georgetown. And, wow, that was awesome. We're going to take a quick break. I got to see if the gunner's still around. Mike and Mike coming up next as we continue on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio.